from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the U.S. Surgeon General recently released a landmark report calling for a cultural shift in how we think about addiction. The report states that addiction is a chronic illness, not a moral failing, and it comes at a time when 1 in 7 Americans will experience substance abuse at some point in their lives. We'll discuss the report, why the stigma surrounding addiction is so pervasive, and share ideas for improving access to effective treatment. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy recently released Facing Addiction in America. It's a report calling for an end to addiction stigma and focusing on the neurological effects of substance abuse. Drug overdoses have continued to surge, and an estimated 21 million Americans struggle with substance abuse disorders, more than the number of Americans with cancer. And addiction now costs the United States over $420 billion a year in health care costs, lost economic productivity, and cost to the criminal justice system. In this opening Forum Hour, we discuss the Surgeon General's report and addiction in America. Joining us in studio is Connie Wisner. She's professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF and associate director of behavioral health research in the Division of Research at Kaiser Permanente and an editor of the report Facing Addiction in America, the Surgeon General's report on alcohol, drugs, and health. And welcome, Connie Wisner.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Anna Lemke with us. She joins us this morning by phone from Stanford, where she's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University Medical Center. And she's also the author of Drug Dealer, MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. Anna Lemke, welcome to the Forum program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
We'll also say good morning to Jim Hood, although he's off on the East Coast. We're joined by him from Westport, Connecticut. He's co-founder of Facing Addiction. It's a nonprofit that helped launch the Surgeon General's report. Welcome, Jim Hood.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Michael. And hi, Connie and Anna.
And good morning to you. Hello, everybody. And let me begin, Connie, with you. This report certainly has stirred up a great deal of interest, especially about stigma, and I want to get to that with you. But the idea of adopting appropriate evidence-based prevention, treatment, and recovery strategies as a top public health priority is a great idea from anybody's standpoint. Implementing it, that's the real challenge. And they're talking about, as the Surgeon General is talking about, the necessity of a major cultural shift, change in attitudes. What's the method of doing, really bringing that to fruition?
The report talks about many methods of doing this. First of all, prevention, treatment, integrating with the healthcare system, and recovery. Very long, as a backdrop to this, very long, the substance use system, treatment system has been totally separate from healthcare, has very seldom been covered by insurance, and has been really conducted in separate programs. This has really helped develop stigma about this problem, that it isn't neurobiological, that it is a matter of the will. And there's a great deal of research now that this report talks about that shows, in fact, that it is a brain disease and that treatment is very effective. There are prevention and treatment strategies, evidence-based. The earlier we address them, the better.
And it also talks about integrating services within the healthcare system, like any other condition in terms of substance abuse. There may be some resistance to that now with the Trump administration. I think we have to probably concede. But where does will play a role in all this? I mean, neurobiology notwithstanding, and there's a lot about that in the report, but many people would certainly argue that will has to play some kind of role, and you can't all blame it on necessarily on neurobiology.
Mm-hmm. I think it probably plays the same kind of role that will plays in people eating high sugar diets when they're diabetic or not exercising when they have hypertension and so forth. The whole idea of integrating with healthcare, which I think is going to be independent of what happens after the election, is that individuals need to be screened when they're in primary care. It's very quick. There are evidence-based ways of doing this. Just a few questions.
And they're not being used, really, at this point. That's the point, isn't it?
It is the point. Except it is now starting to be used. And, for example, the place where I do research here at Kaiser Permanente, 86% of people with a primary care visit are being screened. And this is happening in many other health systems at all. Physicians are finding that it is actually very useful in managing their patients. Remember, we're not just talking about a primary disorder. We're talking about a whole spectrum of at-risk use, and addressing that can be very easy at early points. Physicians are finding it very helpful in terms of managing other chronic diseases like hypertension, diabetes, and so forth, just as they do with other risk factors. Identifying people early can help with management of these other problems.
But we're also talking, and let me go to you on this, Anna Lemke, about seeing addiction as a chronic illness and not so much as a character flaw. I mean, to really diminish the stigma that's often associated with addiction. And in that way, there's analogous, I suppose, to early attitudes toward HIV or continuing attitudes toward cancer. But again, we're talking about addiction as a brain disease or not a character flaw. Where does will play its role in this? Or is it simply to be negated?
Yeah. So, Michael, I actually think that, you know, reasonable people can disagree on whether or not addiction is an illness. But I do think for practical reasons, our society and especially medicine has to embrace addiction as an illness. Because if we don't, we're at risk to ignore it and actually contribute to the problem. It's also really important to recognize that any substance use, drug or alcohol use problem is a spectrum disorder. So there are people who use alcohol and drugs in a way that really doesn't qualify as the disease of addiction, but is probably, you know, not healthy use. And then you have people way over on the end of the spectrum who probably really do have something akin to a brain disease. And let me just give you a little example of a patient of mine. She called me up. She had relapsed to alcohol. She has an alcohol addiction. And she said to me, "Dr. Lemke, I'm in my house surrounded by empty vodka bottles, and I can't stop drinking. Will you help me?" And so here's somebody who totally understood that she had a problem, had perfect insight, and yet had lost the will to choose what she wanted to choose. That is the disease of addiction. The follow-up to her story is I said to her, what you need to do is you need to go to your local emergency room and tell them that you're suicidal. And she said to me, "Dr. Lemke, I'm not suicidal. I want to live. That's why I'm calling you. I want help." I said, "I know that. But if you go there and say you're an alcoholic and you want help with alcoholism, they're going to turn you away. If you say you're suicidal, you might get admitted, and then they'll help you out." So getting back to what Connie was talking about, that's the huge flaw in our medical system today. We don't have a way within the House of Medicine to help people with this very serious problem. But at the same time, we're happy to help them with other severe mental disorders, from obesity to, you know, really you name it. But addiction has been really left outside of this. And this is why this Surgeon General report is so pivotal. It's really shining a spotlight on what is a huge public health problem that needs to be brought into the House of Medicine.
Let me bring Jim Hood into this. And again, he's a co-founder of Facing Addiction, which is a nonprofit, and helped launch the report of the Surgeon General. And the import of the report, again, seems to want to take away the stigma. And it wants to take away the stigma to a great degree, tied to the notion that, well, again, this we're talking about disease here, Jim Hood.
Well, hi, Michael. I think Connie and Anna did a terrific job of addressing that. But I think, yes, we are, I believe, I think we are unassailably and irrefutably talking about an illness. We are talking about a disease. I have some heart or honest point of view that, you know, reasonable people could view this thing differently. But everything changes. Once you allow yourself to view addiction as an illness, we project less stigma. The people suffering feel less shame. Maybe, logically, they're more likely to seek help, to seek treatment. It's astonishing that only 1 in 10 people currently suffering from addiction ever receive any treatment in this country, which the Surgeon General talked about. I mean, imagine if that were cancer or heart disease. It would be outrageous. There would be people in the streets, yet only 1 in 10 people suffering from addiction ever seek any treatment. And I think as soon as you recharacterize this thing as an illness, yes, admittedly, a spectrum disorder, but as an illness, individuals respond differently. We look at those suffering differently. And as Anna just said, the system opens up and suddenly embraces them as people who need medical help rather than going to some, you know, strange building in a back alley to be treated. So, yes, I think the Surgeon General's reaffirmation, by the way, we've known this for some period of time, but for America's doctor to stand up and say this is an illness, it is a serious public health issue, yet talking as much about stigma as medical solutions, I think, sent a very, very strong message to America.
Well, what's the likely effect or the impact of this report? I mean, the Surgeon General's report on smoking back in the 50s and 60s and pointing out that smoking was linked to lung cancer actually had a lot to do with warning labels on cigarette packages and so forth. I mean, are you looking toward something along those lines to follow through here?
Yes, I think so. I mean, even in my humble opinion, and I come to this as a family of loss and a fellow who spent a long career in business, so I don't have Connie or Anna's medical training.
Forgive me, you had a son who was an addict and died of an overdose? Is that?
Yes, I did, four years ago. And it's,
yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Very, very difficult. It's soul-crushing and life-changing, and even more so because to add to the litany of sins here, addiction is not inherently a fatal disease, yet we lose someone to alcohol or other drugs every 4 minutes in this country, and if you got out a really sharp pencil, it's probably more frequent.
Let me just add a little facts to context here, because a lethal dose now goes for as little as about $3 on the streets, and we're seeing addictions of all kind surging, prescription drugs, opioids, heroin, obviously, just across the board. I'm sorry, Jim, please continue.
No, you're 100% right. I mean, in the most unfortunate definition of a perfect storm, we have one here because, and I talk to a lot of my contemporaries, you know, folks who have young kids or teenage kids. And the conversation goes something like this. You know, look, Jim, when I was in college, we drank, we used marijuana. Maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't, but we did. And we're fine. You know, we're fine. My kids are going to be fine. Well, maybe. Part of the answer is you're fine, but you might have been lucky, so let's not get too arrogant. But I think what's lost on an awful lot of parents today is a generation ago, an awful lot of folks stopped with alcohol and then marijuana, and it was relatively rare to hear about people doing that other crazy stuff. It's not so relatively rare now. First, it's starting younger. Kids move from alcohol to marijuana to opioids, and you were just alluding to heroin, much faster and much more frequently, and they go through the whole continuum in ways that wasn't the case, and that's the perfect storm. And then they do it younger, which is a death sentence, which is a formula for disaster. So yes, the heroin at the end of that continuum is more plentiful and less expensive than it has ever been, which is a disaster.
And let me go back to Anna Lemke here, because Anna, I know you wanted to weigh in here, and I'd like to hear what you have to say on this.
Well, I mean, I agree that, you know, we're living in a different world than even 30 years ago. And that's something that many older folks, let's say people, you know, in their 50s and 60s, baby boomers typically don't recognize, in my experience, they sort of have a, you know, laissez-faire kind of perspective on drug and alcohol use. But young people today are confronting a very different world than young people did a generation or two ago. The access to hard drugs is unprecedented, you know, and then you add to that the rapid communication fostered by the internet and the way that kids film each other intoxicated or do little kind of promotional YouTube videos about how they're using and what the effects are and certain recipes. It's really a brave new world and a scary one for young people today. And that's another reason why, you know, the Surgeon General's report is so vital. We really need to acknowledge that the world has changed, that the access to hard drugs has increased, that this is a much riskier world for our young people, and we need to come together. And as Vivek Murthy often comments, you know, use our collective will to come up with creative solutions to this problem.
And this has become certainly a major problem in low- and middle-income white communities across the nation as well, wouldn't you say, Anna?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, probably one of the reasons that propelled the report, sadly, is that, you know, we've now got white middle class folks involved in a terrible, you know, drug and alcohol related morbidity and mortality. You know, drug and alcohol use has been a problem for a long time, but it's really not till it started to penetrate, you know, the white middle class. And also, I do think that the prescription drug epidemic and the fact that doctors are essentially now the source of many of these addictive drugs is what has, you know, the silver lining of that tragedy is that we've now been forced to kind of wake up and acknowledge we've got a serious problem here and do something about it. And I do think that has happened with Vivek Murthy at the helm and Obama's, you know, $1.1 billion pledge. And so the good news is that there is a paradigm shift going on, more awareness around this problem, more dollars dedicated to it. Of course, the sad part is that we do have, you know, it's basically the modern plague.
I want to hear from Connie Wisner on this, but before you weigh in here, Connie, there's been some pushback, particularly from, well, people like Dr. Manny Alvarez, who is a Trump enthusiast and basically says that this political the Surgeon General report is a political attempt to make sure that Affordable Care Act is continued and that essentially what's called Obamacare is continued. And basically he says too little too late. I wonder what your response is to that.
I really think that the things that Anna and Bob are talking about are really independent of that. I want to really emphasize that the issues with kids and that we were talking about can be addressed with screening in pediatrics. There's many studies that are showing innovative ways of doing that. And the report addresses prevention, evidence-based prevention, evidence-based treatment, and recovery. This is the best way to deal with stigma and discrimination for our field. Health systems are finding that this is cost-effective. It's having positive effects on the family, and it is really a separate phenomenon than whatever happens with the Affordable Care Act at this point.
Well, I'm looking at, again, Dr. Alvarez's comments. He says, more use prescription opioids than tobacco. Where has he been, meaning the Surgeon General?
Well, he is the first person who has taken this on.
And as the Obama administration goes out, though, that's why I guess it's seen mm-hmm. in a political light.
I think, you know, the parity bill, for example, had bipartisan support
yes, it did.
In 2008. I think that there has been a bipartisan recognition of the importance of alcohol and other drugs, the opioid epidemic, that the emphasis that is there in this report, the evidence that is there, that this is preventable, it is treatable. I don't think that it's had that audience before. And I think that those mechanisms are really related to other legislative changes that happened prior to the Affordable Care Act, as well as the Affordable Care Act.
And I think, Jim Hood, that what's so staggering about this report is just the numbers we're looking at mm-hmm. here. I mean, the number of substance abuse disorders is comparable to the number of people suffering from diabetes, for example.
Yes, and just to that earlier conversation, I couldn't agree with Connie more. It's always such a conundrum to ponder the question, if someone causes something good to happen, why didn't she or he do it earlier? It's just one of those, you know, Mobius strips that can't be answered. I mean, I think if you look back at history, our society through all sorts of political reigns of both sides of the aisle, we have largely been arresting people who have suffered from substance use disorder for 30 or 40 years. So now when you finally have America's doctor standing up and doing something fairly bold, fairly definitive, and is probably going to be helpful, and to suggest that it might be disingenuous because it only happened now, it just seems to me not to be productive.
Lana Lemke.
Yeah, so getting back to the whole Obamacare thing, Obamacare extended health insurance to millions of people in this country, including the most vulnerable among us, those in poverty, those who are unemployed, and those are the people who are also most vulnerable to addiction. So this is not like Obama suddenly, you know, said, oh, I guess going out, you know, I better say something about the opioid epidemic. Not at all. Also, Connie Wisner points out the Addictions Equity and Mental Health Parity Act. That was a huge, huge statement, and also dovetailed closely with Obama saying that insurance companies couldn't turn people down because they had pre-existing conditions. That was such a boon to my patient population. I cannot even tell you, patients that I treat now because of Obamacare, and they couldn't get insurance before because they had mental health issues and they had addiction issues, those people now have access to treatment. So to come now and say that, you know, this report is just sort of like political grandstanding is ridiculous. I mean, Obamacare is essentially for these vulnerable people who struggle with things like addiction.
And again, the numbers are staggering. There are 66 million who admit to binge drinking just over the last month in this report. Other figures like 78 people a day dying of opioid overdose. And other data that I think is important to compute in the kind of risk we're talking about nationwide, there's a greater risk, for example, of becoming an alcoholic if you have your first drink, a child does before the age of 15, four times more likely to become addicted. And 70% who try an illicit drug before the age of 13 develop a substance abuse disorder within 7 years. So we're talking so much about prevention and treatment and really the need to get the scale of this problem into some kind of perspective. We're going to invite your calls here, of course, and get your response. We're talking about the Surgeon General's report. There are more tools to prevent and treat substance misuse, as you've been hearing, to help people stay substance-free. About 12.5 million are addicted to prescription painkillers, and those numbers, again, just are monumental. Let's hear your thoughts about the Surgeon General's report about addiction, and really, I always entreat those who are listening to come forward with solutions, but also just with your responses. And we do want to hear your comments and do want to hear any questions that you may have as well. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Join us now at that number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking to Jim Hood of Facing Addiction, which is a nonprofit, and Anna Lemke, who is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford Medical Center and the author of Drug Dealer MD, and Connie Wisner, who is Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF and Associate Director of Behavioral Health Research in the Division of Research at Kaiser Permanente. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The U.S. Surgeon General released a landmark report this month calling for a cultural shift in how we think about addiction. And the report also states that addiction is a chronic illness, not a moral failing, and it comes at a time when 1 in 7 Americans will experience substance abuse at some point in their lives. And there's also those Americans who are experiencing being on the border of what is often defined or diagnosed as substance abuse. We're talking about the report, why the stigma surrounding addiction is so pervasive, and why addiction is so pervasive. And we're sharing ideas of improving access to effective treatment with a panel and with your calls and emails. And I'm getting a number of comments right off the top here about race. Let me just read them to you. Kevin comments, now the deliberate drug importation, predatory policies, and multiple waves of white flight have effectively decimated urban communities of color. Guess we might as well start treating suburban addiction as a universal national health issue. Sounds about right. A tweet from a listener says, in brief, whites get treatment, blacks get arrested. Not quite that simple, Connie Weisner, but race does play into this in a big way.
That race has been an issue along with other characteristics in terms of not getting access to treatment. And as Anna has pointed out, the increased access has been very important. The best way to deal with health disparities is to increase insurance.
And we'll bring our callers into this. Let me go first to you, Scott. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to pose a question to the panel related to this idea of treating addiction not as a legal issue and more as a public health issue. Obviously, you all talked a lot about the healthcare side of things, but I was curious to see if you have any vision or any idea of how that integrates with the changes that would be necessary in law enforcement to, you know, also address these addiction epidemics.
Yeah, let me go to you, Jim Hood, on this.
Sure. Thanks for your call, Scott. To be sure, it's it's a complicated issue, and it's going to require a delicate unwinding. You know, people talk about potentially millions of people who are in prison now, and they are largely there because of substance use disorders, addiction, or what have you. It is fairly arguable to say they don't belong in prison, but simply letting all of them out tomorrow is a huge issue. Society needs to be prepared to get those people the treatment that they need, which means beds, which means facilities that don't exist. So I think there is, to be pragmatic, I think there is a vision of what needs to happen, but it is going to be a delicate transition. It will not happen overnight. But make no mistake about it, it must happen. Someone much smarter than me pointed out once that we think of these people as criminals, but in many, many instances, we took six sick people and we put them in prison for some period of time, and then they come out with no choice but to be criminals because they really can't get a life. They can't get a job. They can't get a loan. And so we have to start addressing this.
Connie Weisner.
Drug courts are a very important innovation in this regard. They have been shown to be very effective. And the proliferation of them is definitely something that we should consider policy-wise.
And Anna Lemke, I'd like your response to a personal note we just received from a listener named Jeff. He says, years ago, I became addicted to cocaine. The stigma and the fear of legal reprisal was so strong that I didn't even seek medical help. I fought it on my own. It took me 3 years to finally stop using cocaine. The damage done to my life in general and my career was tremendous, including hepatitis C, liver damage. Years later, I was diagnosed with ADHD. When I discovered my cocaine use with my psychiatrist and neurologist, they told me this was a story they frequently heard, people self-medicating with methamphetamine and cocaine.
Yeah, so Jeff's story is a perfect example of why we need to treat addiction as a medical illness, get insurance companies to pay for treatment, and give people open access to going to their doctor and feeling comfortable saying, I have a problem. We also have to better educate doctors so that they actually ask their patients about these issues. In my experience, when you openly ask patients about substance use problems and really want to know the answer, they'll tell you the truth. So, you know, Jeff's tale is a tragic one. I'm glad it ended well. He seems to be doing well now, but it's exactly why we need to make this shift and embrace addiction as a disease and bring it in the house of medicine. I do want to get back to the other caller's comment about changes in law enforcement. So there's a lot of good movement in this regard. We've got, you know, police officers and for other first responders now carrying naloxone, which can reverse opioid overdose. So, you know, police officers are now looking at these situations as more of a medical issue and even bringing along their own sort of medical interventions. That's really good news. There was just a study that was released looking at treating patients with opioid addiction who are incarcerated with methadone while they're there and seeing how they do compared to people who don't get methadone while incarcerated, because typically once we throw people in prison who have opioid addiction, we stop their methadone treatment. Methadone is a proven beneficial treatment for opioid addiction. So what happens to
although methadone can be an addiction too, of course, and is
of course. Of course, but let me tell you, the evidence is robust and overwhelming that when people get it within A methadone maintenance treatment center, they do much better. But the bottom line is you've got people who go in prison with opioid addiction. They don't get their methadone because their addiction is essentially criminalized and not treated. It would be like going into prison with cancer and not getting your chemotherapy. What happens is these people are released from prison and their opioid overdose rates are tremendous because they return to their usual dose, not realizing they've lost tolerance, and they die by taking too much. So what this study showed is when you offered these, you know, incarcerated people methadone and then connected them to methadone maintenance treatment when they got out, they did much better than people who didn't get methadone in prison. The bottom line is we are looking at the criminal justice system and we are making headway in terms of treating people who go to jail who also have addiction as if they really had an illness and treating their illness while they're in jail.
And just dovetailing on what you've said, I think we need more education, not only for medical doctors in terms of the awareness of and need to probe deeper into problems of substance abuse, but also for police officers to become better educated. It's heartening to hear you talk about advances along those lines. We need more, of course, but I'm going to take another caller here, and that's you, Ben. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. I'm going to take a step away from the chemical addictions and ask a question in terms of other types of addictions. So, you know, when I was younger, I played too many video games, which turned later into a brief stint with gambling addiction. And I've always had the sense that, you know, I've stayed away from drugs and alcohol because I felt like I had that propensity. And I'm seeing some of that stuff with it. Within some of my kids, and I'm wondering how those types of addictions are considered in terms of brain chemistry, in terms of treatment, and whether that was included in the report, and is that also changed in this notion?
Yeah, no. Thanks for the question, Ben, and I'm going to go to you on this, Connie Weissner. I mean, people who talk about medical conditions being allied with addiction say, well, where do you draw the line? You know, if somebody has a shopping addiction, for example, do you say, therefore, they should get psychiatric treatment? And I've been hearing these kinds of things for years now.
I don't think that that would be the situation. I think that I do know that the report does talk about the neurobiology of many kinds of addictions that are related.
Gambling, for example.
Yeah. But I think the real issue here that the report is addressing is that people should pay attention to those kinds of instincts. And it sounds like the caller did, you know, the right thing in terms of how he, you know, moved forward in his life about this. What I do want to get back is for a minute to the other caller and to say, I think that what we forget is that we haven't had an audience to talk about the fact that treatment works. It's sort of the best kept secret that there are over 25 million people in recovery. And that is something that has not been really talked about before this report.
It works, but let me get to the numbers here, because according to the report, 1 in 7 are expected to actually develop a substance disorder, but only 1 in 10 will receive treatment.
Well, again, this gets to the role of the healthcare system. So, for instance, if you don't screen for diabetes, people aren't going to get treatment. We have to start doing that. We have to identify people early, and then hopefully that percentage will increase.
The biggest problem, though, Jim Hood, remains alcohol, does it not? I mean, in terms of the numbers of addicts, et cetera?
It does. Alcohol is still the primary gateway, but I think we're seeing a tilt toward opioids and heroin is arguably doing the most damage and now causing the most deaths. But the whole continuum is a problem, Michael. And I would just add to what Connie said. Absolutely, the medical system needs to embrace these people. But the reason Dr. Murthy talked so much about stigma, it's hard to imagine. It's tragic, but it's hard to imagine if someone were diagnosed with cancer or heart disease or diabetes that their first reaction would be shame and embarrassment. And yet that is so often the reaction with people suffering from addiction that in addition to the system problems, they're just not inclined to seek out treatment. And by chipping away or dramatically, you know, reducing stigma, we can work down that problem.
And we'll bring more callers on. Let me go next to you, Jack. You're on. Morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for my call. I just wanted to offer that recently I've been participating in an intervention of my best friend who lives in New York, and he's an attorney, which is a high-risk group. And the only reason, you know, it's just as Dr. Lipke said, he was brought to the brink of suicide and was able to get into Bellevue Hospital, and they were able to keep him and do an inpatient treatment with him. And the only reason any of this was able to happen is because they just passed a law there requiring insurers to pay for 30 days of treatment for substance abuse. And it was the way I was able to get his partner into treatment as well, because there's financial considerations that basically they just said, we can't go away to get help. They were at the point where they recognized that they needed help and they needed to spend some time focused on a recovery plan, and they couldn't pull themselves away. And only because of this recent law that passed, were they kind of willing and able to say, okay, the cost. And so there's been an incredible support network that has closed around them, but I can't imagine not having those resources and trying to deal with this level of recovery. And they're dealing with crystal meth, which has got some pretty intense physical addiction.
Jack, I appreciate hearing from you, and thank you for that narrative. Let me get another caller on here. Lisa, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a recovering alcoholic, have not had to take a drink in the last 5 years, and I think that one of the things that strikes me is the lack of the general public's understanding, and it goes into the medical field as well, of once you cross the line of, and this is, it's an imaginary or a line you don't see, of going to you can't live without it anymore, and yet you don't want to do it, it is a completely hopeless and helpless place. So I really appreciate this conversation about addiction. The more we make it public, the more people talk about it, the more people come out and seek help in any number of ways is the way that we're going to get people to take away that stigma from this disease, just like we're talking about with diabetes and cancer and the other things that face most of us. So thank you.
Thank you for the call. And apropos of that call, let me read a comment from Sean, who writes, I've worked in this field my entire adult life, and I don't think there's another form of illness so resistant to research and overridden with folk remedies. Even in the recovering community, within families, there exists an almost reflexive antipathy to science-based approaches and understanding. The consequences always end up being moralistic and unforgiving. Shame-based public information campaigns like we see with alcohol and tobacco literally kill people. I've seen it for years. Anna Lemke, weigh in here?
Yeah, so I think Sean, Lisa, and even Jack's, comments really speak to the importance of understanding the neurobiology of addiction. And there's a huge section in the Surgeon General's report that outlines what is the state of the science regarding addiction. And really, there's amazing science out there. People like George Kube and Nora Volkow have done amazing work showing that with chronic exposure to addictive drugs, the brain actually changes. It's a different brain than people started with. The hedonic set point, or the ability to experience pleasure, is different than it was prior to substance use. And essentially, the brain becomes hijacked, which is the common contemporary metaphor, by the drug of abuse, such that nothing else is important. Only obtaining that drug, using the drug, and getting some more is like the entire focus of that individual's survival. And it has nothing to do with their, temperament or morality or upbringing. It's just like they've been taken a hostage by this disease. I also want to comment that, Ben talked about process addictions, or what we call behavioral addictions, started at video games and then went to gambling. There's good neuroscience to show that these kinds of behaviors act very similarly on the brain as drugs and alcohol. And what I see clinically is a very similar natural history. So people start out with, let's say, intermittent pornography use or intermittent video game / gambling, and then over time develop tolerance as their brain adapts to that stimulus. They set to have a new hedonic or pleasure set point, then they need more of that stimulus to get the same effect. And eventually you have people, like I have had patients who come in suicidal because they can't leave their house because they spend all day using internet pornography and masturbating. So it looks so much like drug and alcohol addiction that I think you can't argue it's really the same underlying disease pathology, but it has different phenotypes depending upon that individual's drug of choice.
Again, Anna Lemke is assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford Medical Center and author of Drug Dealer, MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. Here's a comment from Rick who says, my youngest daughter was addicted to painkillers at the age of 15 with the help of a much older predatory boyfriend. Fortunately, she survived and is on a safe path now. We also lost a nephew to an opiate overdose. Whether I vote for a Republican or believe in the bankrupt Affordable Care Act does not influence my concern about this serious problem parents all feel for the lost children. And a question from Tricia says, treatment centers are often run by folks with a certificate, not a medical or psychological degree. These centers often tend to be unprofessional, even if they are expensive. What kind of oversight is there for treatment centers? Jim Hood?
Well, I should defer to the doctors on this call, but I think that is a fair comment. There are unquestionably quite a number of treatment centers that provide efficacious service, ethical service. It's often quite expensive, but there certainly is good treatment. There is a lot of treatment out there that is largely unlicensed, unregulated. There's no evidence that it's very helpful. It can still be expensive, and we know that people can go to some of these treatment centers 6, 7, 8, 9 times and continue to relapse. I think integrating this problem or the response to this problem, intimately into the overall healthcare system will invariably improve the quality of treatment and address that very real concern.
This is one of the huge changes that are
happening. Connie Weister.
This is one of the huge changes that is happening. There are now medications for alcohol and for opioids that programs are taking up. There are performance measures now that are holding programs accountable. And yes, as Jim said, Bob said, moving into the healthcare system is making a huge difference. But I want to really emphasize that when people choose a program, they shouldn't just go by what's been advertised. There are directories on evidence-based programs that are put out by SAMHSA. NIAAA has a new navigator system that can help you find the right program. There are very strong programs as well as the programs that have flaws.
And let me go next to Napa and welcome Tony onto the air here. Tony, you're on.
Thank you. I read an overview of that, the Surgeon General's report, and I was disappointed in it. And here's why. Substance abuse was mentioned too often. I had just recently kicked, basically 6 weeks ago, I've been in a pain clinic. I had what I'll take a taken as directed addiction. And that's something where, again, if you start suffering from chronic pain and they give you Percocet, oxycodone, whatever it is, over the years, you obviously become addicted to that. I didn't know I had become addicted because I didn't mentally feel anything from these drugs, but they did make the pain go away. Well, that's a different thing. I mean, substance abuse, I think that term is not a good term because I didn't abuse any substance myself. I took as directed.
Tony, I'm glad you brought this up. That's why I wanted to make a distinction when I said substance misuse. But a lot of, and let me go to Anna Lemke on this, a lot of problems evolve around doctors giving painkillers out and prescribing maybe promiscuously. Anna?
Yeah, Tony, this is great. I'm glad you gave us this opportunity to talk about the distinction between physiologic dependence and addiction. They're very different things. What you experienced, based on what you said, was physiologic dependence to painkillers, opioids. Anybody who takes an opioid regularly for a sustained amount of time will develop physiologic dependence. There's a process of neuroadaptation in the brain, a change in the pain threshold, such that if you stop taking it, you will experience painful withdrawal. That is not addiction. Addiction is a complex biopsychosocial disease that involves compulsive, out-of-control use and continued use despite consequences. People who are addicted to substances can have physiologic dependence and withdrawal and often do, but dependence alone is not enough to constitute a diagnosis of addiction. In fact, the term substance abuse has been eliminated from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, Edition 4, just exactly for that reason. There's this recognition that we have, especially now, a huge cohort of individuals who took their opioid painkillers as prescribed, became physiologically dependent, but were really never addicted and yet need a lot of help getting off of those painkillers because withdrawal is a harrowing experience. So thank you for raising the important issue of distinguishing between dependence and addiction, and also speaking to the issue of language. Actually, throughout the Surgeon General's report, they try hard. Maybe they didn't achieve it in your opinion, but they try hard to kind of define terms. Use is not a use disorder. Use and misuse are different. Misuse is different from addiction. I don't remember if they actually specifically address dependence without addiction, but if they didn't, you're absolutely right, they should have.
But here, Anna Lemke, is another voice heard from in a tweet I'm looking at. The listener says, laws are freaking out community health centers that prescribe pain medications, making it incredibly difficult for legitimate pain management.
That's absolutely true. You know, unfortunately, in medicine, when we need a kind of a fine instrument, we use a blunt one. And in response to the opioid epidemic, what has happened is a lot of doctors are just simply not prescribing opioids, not treating patients' pain. They just don't want to have anything to do with it because talk about shameful. This has been certainly a shameful episode in medicine's history. So, yes, it's true. It's happening. We have what we call now opioid refugees, pain patients who legitimately need and could benefit from opioid painkillers who cannot get them because doctors are too reluctant to prescribe them.
And Connie Weisner, you get the question, I'm sure, many times in your career. Here it is on my board. Can addiction be hereditary? What do we really know now? It's always been kind of an ongoing moot point for many.
Well, there certainly is a genetic basis for heredity here. And I think you see this sometimes with what Anna was talking about. Some people, for example, who are given opioids for pain do go on to develop a clinical syndrome of dependence, and others don't. So this is we're learning a lot about this. We're developing treatments. Some of the medications that I was discussing before are working at targeting those issues for people.
Jim Hood, can we get you way in here?
Well, I was just thinking about an earlier comment. You know, for all the good things that are happening in this space, and this is one of the reasons, one of the drivers why we created Facing Addiction. Astonishingly, there is no equivalent of the American Cancer Society or the American Heart Association in the addiction space. And the relevance of that, when you look at those other health issues, millions of Americans, just common men and women, have come together to raise their voices, to help educate, to help overcome stigma, to provide sustainable sources of funding that will fuel the necessary research. We've never had anything like that in the addiction space, perhaps because of the stigma and shame. And that is a primary reason we created Facing Addiction, so we can begin to sort of galvanize and focus the attention and the fundraising of this country and finally do something about this at the population level.
Well, we are, as I indicated earlier, getting some personal remarks and statements and narratives from listeners, and some of them are pretty troubling, to put it mildly. Here's a listener who writes, my niece has an opioid addiction and the insurance company wants her to fail outpatient treatment twice before she can get inpatient treatment. She has overdosed twice. This is a travesty. Let me bring more of your calls on. We go to Seattle, Washington, and Jessica joins us from there. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm originally from Santa Rosa in the Bay Area and have just moved up to Seattle where there is a huge opiate problem here. Last year in King County, over 300 people died of overdoses, and they're discussing putting in a safe injection site in Seattle where people would be monitored and overdose would be prevented, as well as counseling services offered. And I was just wondering what services are available in the Bay Area. Also, I have had many friends who have been able to get off of their prescription pain medication or help themselves get off of opiates with medical marijuana. I was wondering if there was anything that you guys had heard that had been related to using medical marijuana and getting off of heroin and other opiate substances.
Yeah, a lot packed in there. Let me go to Anna Lemke, though.
Yeah, so, you know, what Jessica's addressing is a huge movement in the addiction world called harm reduction. And harm reduction is really a philosophical shift away from abstinence-only goals in terms of treatment toward doing things that can limit the harm done by drug and alcohol misuse and addiction rather than just trying to stop the use. So safe injection sites are a great example of that. You provide a place where people can go get clean needles and actually inject on site. And that way you, you know, minimize the risk of transmitted diseases like HIV and hepatitis. The data are really powerful for safe injection sites, showing that they do decrease the risk of harm done to individuals who use drugs in that way. And they also get people into treatment, because once people start going and then they get to know the staff and the people who work there, they might be more interested in treatment. Other examples of harm reduction are clean needle exchanges, like what they've now reinstituted in Indiana after the HIV epidemic that started with Opana, a prescription drug, and then, of course, naloxone to reverse overdose.
Running short on time here. I'm sorry, Anna. I'm going to have to interrupt you and getting some pushback comments, which I wish we had time to read, but I'm looking at the clock here, and it's telling us that time has run out. You can read some of these comments online, though, and in fact, I would encourage you to continue this discussion online. It's a very important one by simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum. I want to thank our guests, Connie Weisner from UCSF and Kaiser Permanente, and Anna Lemke from Stanford, and Jim Hood from Facing Addiction. Thanks to you, our listeners, as well. We wouldn't be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. General manager of KQED is Joanne Wallace. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.